it wouldn't be an episode of the KingCast without a little plug for our longest sponsor. That's right, the masters of microdosing themselves, Lumi Labs. Do you need a little help sleeping? Maybe just want to maintain a nice level of calm and chill throughout the day? Well, Lumi Labs has you covered. If you're stressed out or your mind likes to run a million miles a minute, then you might want to give Lumi Gummies a try. They offer indica, sativa, and hybrid gummies that are designed to be taken in smaller doses to maintain a level of calm throughout the day. Or if you just want the pleasant sensation of being a little bit stoned, you can take a couple more and you're good to go. You enjoy these gummies however you see fit. Myself, I like to pop a Lumi gummy before bedtime, and that helps me fight off insomnia and my dreaded vampiric sleep schedule that my body refuses to stray from without some sort of outside help. And the best part is you can get them sent straight to your front door, no matter what the marijuana laws are where you live. So check out microdose.com and see their wares. If you decide to pick something up, make sure to use the code KINKCAST at checkout to get 30% off and get free shipping. That lets them know their ads worked, helps the show out, and you get a nifty little discount in the process. It's a win-win, babies. That's microdose.com, code KINKCAST. And of course, I have to tell you that Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible. And it's delivered right to your front door four times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future. With all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-alls to guide the way, including, from time to time, little old me. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online. So if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINKCAST at checkout, you will save a ginormous 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINKCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Stephen Graham Jones.
And we are your hosts. It's an exciting day here at the KingCast. I have two incredible authors here to talk about one of my all-time favorite King stories. First, let me introduce my co-host, who you know who it is because he just said his name, but KingCast regulars will know him as an incredibly talented genre writer and wrangler of just about every kind of dangerous animal on God's green earth. He's Jay Daniels's daddy, and his latest book is I Was a Teenage Slasher, and it's on shelves now. Of course, it can only be Stephen Graham Jones. Say hello once again to the people, Stephen.
Hello, y'all. Hello, and man, I would not want to be Jade's dad because he's not a good dude.
Well, you know, metaphorically and in spirit, you are her father.
Yeah.
And joining us is our guest of the hour. You know him from his Happen Leonard series, The Drive-In, The Bottoms. And his current novel is In the Mad Mountains, a short story collection influenced by Lovecraft, which ties into our topic today, by the way. For movie nerds, you'll know him from, say, Bubba Hotep or his work on Batman the Animated Series. Of course, I'm talking about the one, the only, Joe R. Lansdale. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I mentioned Bubba Hotep at the top of this, and that was my intro, really, to your work. I was a Stephen King kid. I was a Michael Crichton kid, but I wasn't a very adventurous reader. I have to admit that when I was, I don't think I'm as adventurous as I was as a kid, but I kind of got locked in my way. So I kind of missed a lot of your work until our mutual friend, Don Coscarelli, told me one day, he's like, yeah, I'm making this crazy short story about, you know, Elvis is still being alive in a nursing home fighting a soul-sucking mummy. And you should check out this guy's work. And I'm like, well, that sounds right up my alley. And so we can thank Don for my appreciation of your work and actually introing me into your short stories and novels.
You know, should I say my Joe Lansdale origin story?
Oh yeah, sure. While we're talking about it, let's do it.
Yeah, for sure. I first met Joe, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was 2002 in Austin. Is that right?
Yeah, it sounds right.
Yeah, and we'd both been pulled into like a panel at an academic conference on Conan the Barbarian, and I was just thrilled to be anywhere I get to talk about Conan. And at that point, I'd read, I think, the first two Happen Leonard novels. And I had read them because Mike Shea, who is a book reviewer at Texas Monthly, had told me I had to read Joe Lansdale, and he was right. And unbeknownst to me, I'd already read some of the short stories too, and I made all the connections. And anyway, I'm sitting up there by Joe, and we're talking Conan the Barbarian. And really, I was just like an audience member, lucky enough to be up at the table in the front of the room, because I was just listening to Joe talk about Conan the Barbarian and Robert E. Howard and everything. And then in the Q&A period, the first hand that goes up is somebody out there asking Joe. They said, Joe, what genre do you write in? And Joe, without missing a beat, says, I write in the Joe R. Lansdale genre. Next. And that's always been my dream, to answer a question like that I write. I mean, I'd love to write in the Joe R. Lansdale genre, but I'd like to write my own genre too. You know, that's what you want, man. You want to be able to jump bookshelves as much as you want and have the audience come with you.
Exactly.
And we've been talking ever since. Joe and I speak at least once a week, and often a lot more than once a week, about, we're always talking about Neanderthal stuff back and forth.
Yeah. I'm fascinated with them. And there's such a ton of research that's going on right now. And some of it, I'm not sure that they've settled on it. But so much of it is fascinating, and a lot of it, you know, fits my idea of what the Neanderthals were. I never bought the general idea about them, except maybe when I was a kid. And I was in a class at the University of Texas, and I wrote a paper about them, saying that I felt like that they had been assimilated with, you know, modern humans, or what we call modern humans. And at that time, they didn't believe that they could mate. And that couldn't happen. You couldn't have an offspring. And I just felt like that was not right, having no evidence, of course. But then over time, they begin to find enough fossils and evidence to suggest that, yeah, that's what happened. I'm sure that wasn't the only thing that led to their, I don't even know if you could call it extinction, because a lot of us have Neanderthal in us, but it was a different idea. And I think that's always fascinated me. And I've always wondered about it. And Stephen and I were, I was doing a class of his I was in his office. And I think I picked up a book he had on Neanderthal stories if I remember right. I can't remember who did the collection, maybe Asimov.
I think it was Asimov. Is that the ugly kid or the ugly?
Yeah. And it also had in there, you know, one by L. Sprague McCamp. Mm-hmm. In fact, there were plenty of them, and we started talking about that and realized we both had a certain fascination with it. And Philip Jose Farmer, the Alley Man, my absolute.
Oh, favorite. Man. Yeah, that's the best story from that anthology. I love that story.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it doesn't get any better. And I'm so excited. I mean, I'm not excited about global warming, but with all the tundra melting, I think it's just like a matter of time before somebody up in Siberia, the same way they stumble on frozen woolly mammoths and rhinoceroses and stuff, I think we're going to find a Neanderthal or a Denisovan that is in a lot better shape than we've found so far.
Yeah. Certainly possible. Yeah. I want to have them finding riding a prehistoric donkey.
Yeah, for sure, man. Well,
as long as they don't find any Shoggoths up there or anything that proves that Lovecraft was onto something, I'm okay with that. So forgive me for being kind of a Neanderthal Luddite. I don't know too much about them, but this is where all the missing link stuff comes into play, right? Like, what's the link between Neanderthals and us?
Well, I mean, they're not actually an ancestor to us. They're more like a cousin or something. But there was early in our awareness that Neanderthals existed, people were calling them a missing link. Yeah.
Okay.
Like apes and chimpanzees, bonobos, they're all, you know, kin, but they're not the same.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yep. I don't want to prematurely break from the Neanderthal discussion. So if there's some more to talk about, I'm more than happy to do it.
But if you're wanting to break, I can tell.
Well, I just worry about, in my mind, I can see all the Dear Fangoria Podcast Network. I thought this was a Stephen King podcast. Why are they talking about Neanderthals? I can see all that happening in my mind. But I want to say the reason why, like, Steve, before even Stephen, I knew that you knew Joe, which I didn't when I asked you to do this. The reason why you jumped to mind is I think that you and Joe share something in common, which is also something that Stephen King is very good at as an author. And that is, you guys are great at writing about regional things and making it feel like that we're there. right? Like the way King writes about Maine, I feel like I'm there. And like so much to the point where I visited, you know, when I visited Bangor, I go, I feel like I've already know this place because I've, you know, walked these streets in my mind already, right? And both of you gentlemen are very talented at that too. So it was a natural thought, you know, in my mind, whenever Joe, you agreed to come on the show, of asking Stephen to come in, because in my mind, you guys were already kind of tied together in that way, and that you're very great at setting your novels. You're very great at setting the stage, and making it feel realistic. And, you know, I live in Texas. And so, you know, when I read your stuff, Joe, I go, yep, I recognize. I mean, maybe not so much in Austin anymore, but like the Austin that I moved to in the 90s, you know, had that great mix of, you know, hillbilly cowboys and hippies. And so, and they would all be breaking, you know, cornbread together, right? You know, it's like, that's what gave Austin its identity, which a lot of people, you know, fucking hate that it's gone now, or they complain that they didn't get to experience it at all. But
I was there in the 70s. Mainly when I write, I'm writing about East Texas, which is similar to that, but it's a whole nother animal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
But when I was in Austin, it used to be, that's when the what you call the outlaw country was starting. And that's when people like Willie and Waylon and so on and Chris and others were starting to develop this new approach to country music that often had some philosophical musings in it, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I know what you're talking about. That hippy dippy charm has kind of been lost in Austin, to tell you the truth.
Very much so. And it was kind of lost to the hippies gave way to the hipsters. And that was the first massive change that I saw beyond just the skyline and, you know, all the movement here. But lately it's like, it makes me miss the hipsters, because what we have moving here are all these kind of like dangerous comedian kind of, you know, it's the Joe Rogan effect. We're getting a lot of Elon Musk and Joe Rogan people moving to Austin, which is like throwing the, I sound so shitty saying this, but it throws the vibes off of the city, you know, where it's just all these tech bros now. And it's a different feeling. It really does feel different. And I hate to be that guy. I hate to be the person that's like, oh, this isn't the Austin I know, you know, and like, you know, but I feel like I've spent over 30 years in the city, so I can get a little grace.
Right.
I get a little gray, shaking my fist at the clouds on this, at least more so than the people that moved in like 2011 and are going to the city.
Well, you know, the difference in Austin, and it's, I've never liked those terms hippies and stuff, because it just kind of like lumps everybody to be the same and they aren't.
For sure.
But in Austin, a lot of what happened is the so-called hippie culture integrated with the so-called redneck culture.
Yep.
And so it was a whole different vibe than you would see, say, in Berkeley, for instance, which I lived there briefly, or, you know, was there for a few months. But it's not like that now, not at all.
No. Have you seen much change in, Stephen, I know that you're a Texas boy as well. But you live in Colorado now. So it's, does Colorado have the same kind of fluctuations, or Boulder? Does it have the same kind of fluctuations of personality, or has it always been kind of a,
No, it does have pretty much an exact same trajectory. Actually, I've only been here since 08, but sometimes I'll be up at the tire shop like at 7 in the morning, and the old men are hanging out there just for the free coffee, and I'll talk to them, because that I grew up like at Cotton Gin's. I'd always the old men playing dominoes and eating peanuts were always my babysitters, and so I just I liked hanging out with the old guys who have the good stories. And so I talked to these old guys huddled around the coffee machine at the tire place, and they'll tell me that 40-50 years ago, Boulder was just bars that the cowboys from all the surrounding ranches would come to on the Friday and Saturday nights, and the place had a completely different atmosphere, culture, whatever you want to call it. And slowly, as the money infiltrated in, things changed. And you say y'all have tech bros there in Austin. Here in Boulder, we have what people probably disparagingly call trust fund babies. You know, these people just have unlimited bank accounts. So there's so many amazing cars. I don't even know what they are, cruising around Boulder. And so many
Rivians. You got some Rivians.
Yeah, a whole lot of Rivians. And there's I think the food is terrible in Boulder myself because it's all so fancy. Like you order a plate of food and you get like three little specks on your plate and they're all designed artfully and it's not fun. There's no Whataburger, you know?
No Whataburger, and they probably actually serve their steaks the way they're supposed to be served. Steven. Yeah, Joe, I don't know if you know this about Steve, Mr. Graham Jones here, but he prefers his steaks burnt to a crisp.
I'm in the middle. I used to do rare, but yeah. Then by the time I started eating, it was cold, so I started moving the meat. Yeah.
Well, nice. A good steak has to have a good crust, and I think the medium rare, I think, is the perfect thing, but so many steakhouses don't time it right. So I always order medium because I know if it's a little on the rare side, it's okay. If it's a little overcooked, it's going to still be pink and okay. Right. So yeah.
My wife always said, if it was smoking, it was cooking. If it was burnt, it was done.
I think that's where Steven is. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my uncles growing up, they'd always watch me eat and they'd say, all I like is burnt grease with ketchup on it, which I think is true. Yeah.
Well, Steven's done the show multiple times, so we don't need his Stephen King origin story. But Joe, this is your first time on the show. So what is your Stephen King origin story?
I believe it was Night Shift. I'm always loved short stories better than novels. I mean, I write both and I do love both of them, but I've always preferred short stories. And I remember finding, and he had been around. I take that back. The first one was Carrie, and I read from a book club and I liked it.
Yeah.
But I had kind of, you know, not paid attention to the things that had come out after that. But I found Night Shift whenever it came out, and I read that. That made me going to find out more about Stephen King. And I actually reread Carrie at some point and thought, okay, this is even cleverer than I thought it was.
Right.
And then I switched to Salem's Lot, and then I did The Shining, and then The Stand, and Dead Zone, and you know, so on, pretty much in as they were written. But I also jumped around later on and read them out of order, you know. I read Revival right after I read 11/22/63,
yep.
But I had missed several of them in front of 11/22/63, so I was kind of jumping around.
That's an odd period for King. 11/22/63 is kind of a major work from him. I think it's an incredible book. I love it.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, me too.
It might be my favorite. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah. But it's definitely, it's the one that kind of marks like the second renaissance of King for me. Cause he has a rough patch after the accident. And there's stuff in there I love. I'm a big Dark Tower fan, so like I love his Dark Tower series, and you know, he made that a priority post-accident, getting those books finished. And you know, it's a little woolly and a little messy the way that series concludes, but I still love it with my full heart, and maybe I love it because of its wooliness and messiness. But you know, there's a lot of dream catchers in that group. There's a lot of work in that time where it feels like he's finding his voice again. And 11/22/63 just feels like a master at the top of his craft just goes, oh yeah, and by the way, I still have this in me. And then he proceeds to do another 15 years of like banger after banger.
Yeah, he does. And you know, but the Dreamcatcher, I know that everybody always like doesn't prefer it over the other ones, but I bet Dreamcatcher is in my top five Kings. You know, I love Dreamcatcher, man.
Interesting. Cool. What grabs you about that book?
What grabs me about it is aliens. I love aliens. And they're all up in the woods running around, and I love King is really good at going into characters' heads and making it like a space. And so if I remember correctly, is it Mr. Gray? Somebody is in somebody's head, and all their memories are this huge wall of never-ending file cabinets, and you have to find the right memory in the file cabinet. I just love that so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of, I'm trying to think of, the Children of the Damned, which was called the Midwich Cuckoos, you know, and that one, you know, they're building a brick wall between them because all these children have this. They were actually the children of aliens that mated with human beings, and it's just great stuff. It's John Wyndham, you know,
right? I don't know that one.
You know, John Wyndham wrote the Day of the Triffids, and
yeah.
numerous great books and stories, but The Midwich Cuckoos and the movies were Children of the Dam is incredible because this guy tries to use his mind to stop them because they use their mind, their mental power. Yeah. To wreck certain havoc. And so in that, he's stacking a wall and building it in the movie. I think it's in the book too, if I recall.
Wow.
Back when I was a kid. But I love that book, and I love the Day of the Triffids novel. It's just fantastic. And all that stuff that Wyndham did. He was the first science fiction writer I read that I thought was not just writing an adventure story for children or for young people. But he was starting to do things like there was a lot of introspection. There's a lot of psychology, strong characters. I mean, pretty amazing writer. He's one of my favorite science fiction writers.
Nice. I need to look. I have not read any of his. I need to look him up.
Somehow I missed other names too. I think John Binion Harris and something else are here and there. So
nice. Yeah. I mean, you had to have six different names to make a living, huh?
Yeah.
Now you're getting by with three, Steve. Can I ask you guys a writerly question before we dive into the topic at hand?
Sure. I also want to talk about Joe's Sugar on the Bones and the Thicket adaptation if we get a chance, man.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me throw this out first, and then we can dive into that. I mentioned the talents involved of both you two and Stephen King and being able to capture region-specific feel and tone authentically. And I'd like to ask you guys, like, what's the key into that? Is that listening to people and how the rhythm of their speech and the kind of words they use and having that in the dialogue? Is it in the description of the area? Like, what is the key to you when you know you kind of nail, like, oh, this is the region, this is how it reads as authentic, even against a backdrop of maybe something wholly ridiculous or supernatural or out of this world?
Man, you know, for me, it's not actually about technique or craft like that. It's more about my attitude on approach. And I think that attitude is just not being embarrassed about where you come from and believing in where you come from. That doesn't mean you have to agree with everything that goes on where you come from. Generally, you're against 98% of it,
right?
Like I am. But I'm not embarrassed to have grown up in West Texas, and I still have like deep associations with just the mesquite, the dryness, the fences, the trucks, the roads, the sun, all of it. And it feels the most real between my fingertips of any place. I really think that writers probably only ever know the emotional contours of a single landscape. And for me, that'll always be West Texas. And I can't escape that. And I don't try to escape it either. And I think because I don't try to escape it, I'm then sometimes lucky enough to get it on the page intact.
I think I almost have exactly the same answer. I believe that where I would just add something is that I really couldn't do anything else, write about anything else, because that's what I know, and it's in my bones. And if you're a Texan, I think you're from birth, you're just sort of feel like you're different, and you feel like you're special. At the same time, sometimes you don't think everything's so special, you know?
Right. Yeah, for sure, man.
Uniqueness. There's a mythic power to Texas. It's a country of its own. And I think it's why so many people are attracted to it. You know, I don't agree with the politics. I'm not religious in the way that a lot of Texans are. In fact, I'm not religious at all. But the same guys that would vote for people I wouldn't and go to church every Sunday, if my car broke down, I know they'd stop me and help me out.
Yeah.
It's just a strange sort of weirdness that they're not my enemy. I don't see them that way.
Right.
I mean, there may be an individual here and there that I don't like.
name their name, Joe, right now.
Yeah.
Put a fatwa on them. Yeah.
But you know, pretty much I feel comfortable with these people. I know how to talk to them, and I can also see the son of a bitch is coming. You know, like when I lived out in Berkeley, you had a lot of really, let's say, really liberal-minded people in the 70s. But, you know, you never really knew where they stood because they seemed just like they were wearing a suit of clothes that didn't exactly fit them sometimes. And when they did, that was great. But, you know, I found the same prejudice, the same things I don't like, clothed in, like I said, different suits. But you know, it's just anywhere you're going to find good people, bad people, people you agree with, people you don't, and people who think you're the bad people because you don't agree with them. You know, so it's. But in Texas, I can see people coming, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny, Eric, you were talking about us being Texas writers, and people who aren't from Texas will often put me and Joe in the same pot. Like, y'all go together, and we are friends, and we are both Texas, but like Joe said, East Texas and West Texas are just completely different.
And it's not just because one's dry and one's lush. It's more than that. It's a culture that's grown up, perhaps influenced by geography. I don't think there's any way you can avoid that influence of geography and weather. But, you know, we're living in a part here where it's trees and water. It doesn't look like anything that people think of as Texas. And in fact, I constantly have to remind them. And even people that read my book, some of the artists, they want to draw like cactus. Usually it doesn't exist unless it's in a garden plot.
I remember when I moved to Austin, I was 12 when we moved here, and we moved from California, right? So it was like in the early 90s, there was the big tech boom. So I lived in the Bay Area of California for the first 12 years of my life. Then I moved here, and I had that same fucking thing in my head where I was just like, moving to Texas. So we're going to have to wear cowboy hats and boots, and it's going to be rattlesnakes and dust and tumbleweeds and cactuses. And then we're flying into Austin, and it's rolling green hills, the giant lake. It's, you know, and I was just like, what is this? This is like more green than the part of California I just left, you know?
It would be different, though, where Stephen comes from would not look like that exactly. No. It's a different look. And if you go over here to East Texas, it doesn't look and it's, East Texas is about the size of Italy. And all these different sections are huge. There's bigger sections than East Texas. But yeah, I know when I drive over to Santa Fe to visit George Martin, and I'm driving that way. And as we get up in, we used to get up around close to Amarillo and go through that. There's a road there. I can't remember what, but we go through El Paso and things like that. And you get out there, there are stretches where, man, there's nothing and the phone don't work. And expect to be mugged by a roadrunner. It's just,
yeah, you do. Yeah. You know, when I first moved to Colorado, I kept seeing people like out past the fence, off the shoulder of the road, they'd be just out there. And I would always look away, because that's what I learned to do growing up in West Texas. When you see somebody out in the pasture, you look away because you know they're out there burying something they don't want the law to find, you know? But here up here in Colorado, they're just out hiking with their golden retriever and having a great day. It's a totally different world.
Yeah. Well, you know, the shuttle blew up over Nacogdoches as well as, you know, other areas in East Texas, but we really got it. And, you know, stuff landed in our yard from the shuttle.
Wow.
And when they went out to look for the bodies of the astronauts or what was left of them, they discovered like several graves of people they didn't even know were dead and buried.
Oh, man. But, you know, they're like novels like your, like Joe's, like all your novels, really. But like Moon Lake couldn't be set anywhere but where it's set. You know, you can't move it up to Wisconsin or even West Texas, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, people will think, oh, God, that's loony. It's so weird you made that up. And a lot of times that's stuff I've taken right out of things that exist. You know, there's these weird things that, and I'm sure every place has this weird, as Stephen King shows in Maine. But, and in fact, his Maine people remind me a lot of East Texas people in many ways. Yeah. You know? But there's a uniqueness about Texas. And I think East Texas is a little different, but there's a kind of darkness that floats through these woods that doesn't float elsewhere. And there's a kind of joy in those woods and in those long green shadows. And I just love, you know, I live in woods. I have, you know, some acreage and it's backed up against woods, and it's just wonderful to get up and go out there. And there's, you know, there's coyotes and there's hogs and there's deer and all kinds of birds, all kinds of snakes too, including all the poisonous ones. But it's just, for me, it's so unique. And it's kind of a, you know, it's like eating something that's sweet and bitter at the same time, you know. Right. I couldn't imagine living anywhere else unless I just had to, you know. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's also something about the small towns that that y'all write about as well. And there's an authenticity to it, you know, and that's also, there's something about the way King writes small town life too, that, you know, just nails it. And it's like you said, it's all connected. It all feels like a small town in East Texas, a small town in West Texas, they'll have their own identity, but they'll also have a lot of commonality. A small town in Maine will have a commonality. They'll just say Aya instead of y'all. Or, you know, it's like, you know, but there's a lot of that, I think, difference as well, and just like kind of a rural setting that's interesting. I think it especially plays very well in genre. I don't know if it's because of the isolation aspect. I don't know if it's
Part of it. You know, you hit on something there. When I was writing, there had been a few people from East Texas who had published books here and there, but there was no consistent East Texas writer. I certainly genre writer before I was here. That doesn't mean there weren't people who had from here, like William Humphreys and people like that, that had written these things. But there was something about that that was consistent, not necessarily somebody that had only written some, you know, a few books in East Texas, some stories, but I was consistent. And there was me and Ardeth Mehar in East Texas. Now, there were places outside of East Texas where there were others, but it was like a lonely place for writers who wrote about East Texas.
Right.
And now they're everywhere.
Yeah.
They're multiplying.
And I like to feel, and according to a lot of the writers I've talked to, that I opened that door for people to say, hey, it's okay to write about here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And, you know, you do get the isolation in small rural towns, but you also get a lack of anonymity. I feel like in a big city, you can go to the grocery store and not see a single person you know. But in a small town, you're going to know the person checking you out. Y'all probably dated in sixth grade or something, you know, it's all
right
crossing with each other.
Yeah. Well, you know, the isolation, I think of, you know, I was never a lonely child. I was alone, but not lonely. I always had so many interests, and I like being by myself a lot. I'm gregarious, but I can be by myself easily or with my, you know, me and my wife.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, it I think it makes you turn inward a little bit more because it makes you, you know, you're grasping for something that's interesting. And when I was about 4 years old, I discovered comic books, and the black and white of the world suddenly had color poured into it. I was reading those comics, and I wanted to write and draw comics. And I did, you know, not very well, of course, as a kid, but I was already starting because I was reading really early. I was a precocious little shit. And I was reading all this stuff. And then I started reading books, and Edgar Rice Burroughs in particular, you know, when you're a kid is just like catnip, especially a boy. And I was hooked from then on. I didn't want to be a writer. I had to be a writer. And I started absorbing everything I could get my hands on. You know, I might read when I was a little older, I might read Hemingway 1 week, you know, and then I might read Philip Hosea Farmer the next week. And, you know, I was always reading a little bit of this, a little bit of that, plus history, anthropology, all of that stuff influenced me. But I think that comes from, to some extent, that isolation of not knowing what's good for me, but just knowing what I wanted. And when a book fell in my lap, or somehow I got it, because we didn't have a bookstore there. We had a spinner rack and comic books in one place. We didn't have a library. We had a bookmobile. And so sometimes the kind of book that you thought you might not like wasn't there. And so I would go, okay, what the hell? I'm going to read this. You know, if Jack London wasn't there that week, I might read something that, you know, I wouldn't normally read. And I think that helped. I think it gave me a wider view of the world and made me realize that there are a lot of things to like that are not alike.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I mean, yeah, you are alone a lot when you're a kid in a small town, but you're never lonely if you got something to read, I don't think. But
No. And I agree with Steve, too, is that the thing about small towns is everybody knows you, you know, or a lot of people know you, and you know, you go in there and say, well, I seen old Billy Sue in there with Wilbur, and that ain't her husband. Word gets spread around before you know it. Somebody's, you know, talking about somebody else, even if they don't know shit about what's really going on. That's the thing, you know, you have to mind your P's and Q's maybe a little bit better because somebody knows you. And I will meet people that I don't think know me, but because of my writing, they do. And that's even more under the spotlight. You feel like, you know, that Michigan J. Frog, hello, my baby, hello. You're supposed to perform, you know?
Yeah.
All I have a couple of nifty things to tell you about here in today's mid-roll, starting with Traction Park Massacre. A group of friends meet outlaw bikers, meet feral twin psycho killers in a notorious abandoned water park. Get ready to revisit the 80s slasher vibes with Traction Park Massacre from the minds of directors Adam Dubin and Douglas DeMonda. This film takes you on a wild ride inspired by the infamous Action Park, featuring an abandoned amusement park, urban legends, and killer twins who will stop at nothing to protect their turf. With a score by Testament's Alex Skolnick, Traction Park Massacre promises thrills, chills, and a bloody good time. Coming in 2025. Don't miss it. You can watch the trailer now at TractionParkMassacre.com, presented by Terror Twins LLC. Now let's talk about The Eye of the Salamander. Here's what I got on this one. A nutty archaeology professor pokes his nose into the wrong Aztec artifact. This opens in theaters November 1st in LA, Miami, Atlanta, Dallas, and Chicago. An Aztec pyramid figurine found in the ancient city of Teotihuacan in the Valley of Mexico stores a dark secret, which is discovered by Professor Hiscock, a non-traditional hero who will learn quantum teleportation the hard way, facing primal folklore fears and his alter ego in the gruesome catacombs of an uncharted realm. And, of course, in an ancient creatures unleashed into the world. Director Pavel Nikolaev describes the plot as Indiana Jones meets the Doom video games, with a crazy scientist added into the mix. Inspired by the classic 80s sci-fi horror films, this movie is shot with mostly practical effects and minimum CGI. There are going to be a couple of Q&As you want to keep your eye out for. If you live in Southern California or Atlanta, Georgia, this is going to be pertinent to you. One Q&A will be held this Friday, November 1st at Studio Movie Grill in Atlanta. The second that I want to tell you about is at the Lemley Glendale in California on Saturday, November 2nd. The Q&As will happen after the primetime shows in both cities. Listen, you had me at Indiana Jones meets Doom. I'm excited to check this one out. If you happen to be in Glendale or Atlanta, report back. Let me know what you think. But now it's time to get back to the show.
Yeah. What about, Sugar on the Bones, Joe? When I read that, is that number 13 in the series? Is that right?
It is. It's number 13. It is.
Yeah, man. I know 13 has a lot of like superstition around it, and I was nervous going into Sugar on the Bones, and I'm not going to spoil anything, of course, but the deeper like any of us get into any series we're reading, I think there's always the more chance that there's going to be less characters at the end than there were at the beginning. So the higher you get in the Happen Leonard series, the more I'm on the edge of my chair while I'm reading, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, the thing is, and it actually ends in Colorado actually.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Or mostly the thing is that if you write books where everything's safe, I think it kills the suspense. But if you write books where anything can happen, you mm-hmm. can piss a reader off. That's for sure. But mm-hmm. I always said that I think most people liked to feel surprised, and uh-huh. I don't write with other people. I write like everybody I know is dead. I'm writing uh-huh. for me, you know, uh-huh. and I write for me just because I want to sell out, Stephen, but yeah. I can't yeah. quite figure out what other people want. I know what I want, so I just decide to write for me as best I can and hope that I pull some people along. And yeah. I'm different than a lot of writers is that some books I know, I said, this isn't going to appeal to a ton of people, but by God, I'm going to write it anyway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I have that instinct, but I have had such a wonderful career and a wonderful life. In fact, writing in the way I used to read, which was that variety, you know?
Yeah.
And for me, I think that makes me a better writer. I love Happen Leonard, but if I only wrote Happen Leonard, I think I would lose the plot, so to speak. Mm, yeah. So it's wonderful to jump and write The Thicket or to write Bottoms, you know, mm-hmm. Cold in July and all these mm-hmm. different things and all the short stories, especially. I think, I don't know how many, I think I've got about 400 short pieces. Some of those are articles and essays and stuff. But mm-hmm. to me, it's just the perfect life as a writer.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. And you're totally right. I think the key to longevity in your career as a writer is to not get hemmed in, not have to write the same book over and over and over.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And then when you write for other people, it killed. If I wanted to work at the aluminum chair factory, I could still do that. I did work at the aluminum chair factory. But this way, I don't feel like I am because I go, what's exciting? What's new? Yeah. You know? I don't plot or do any of those things. I get up and it's there and I'm ready to go. Some days are harder than others, of course, but generally speaking, I love it so much that it gives me a little bit of a pass that I think a lot of writers who don't have that same feeling don't get. Because some writers like having written, but they don't like writing.
I know. That's always so weird to me. I think if writing ever becomes a chore, or if I don't want to go to the keyboard and write, then I won't write because it's not fun anymore. But I'm always afraid that somehow I'm going to turn writing into a chore, and I never want to do that.
Yeah, well, I was always afraid of that too, which is why I didn't. But I was always aware of it. I would look at friends of mine, and some of them excellent writers, but I could tell they felt trapped in the kind of books they were writing. That's what their audience expected, you know? And my audience is a variety of people and different kinds of people, from young to old to middle age to, you know, hippies and hipsters and rednecks. And, you know, not everybody's going to read me because they're not going to always agree with me. And I'm okay with that. But I just feel like that way I'm satisfied. So when I get up in the morning, I don't feel like I'm nailing my dick to the desk.
Yeah. No, and I totally agree with you, Joe, that if you as the writer don't like experience discovery while writing the piece, then the reader is not going to experience surprise, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, to connect this a little to King here, King also storyboards for movies, but he doesn't like plot out things. He just sits and kind of discovers as he writes. It sounds like you said just now, Joe, that's kind of how you work too.
Yeah, it is. You know, I might make a note on the envelope, remember his eyes are blue or that he took off his hat, you know,
right.
Most of the time I don't make notes, and people say, how do you keep that in your head? And I don't think about it. And I'm more of a subconscious writer than a conscious writer. It seems like that I'm sure it's in dreams. And I mean, I'm sure I'm plotting in my subconscious unaware, or those stories are revealing themselves in some way I'm unaware, because when I get up in the morning and my feet hit the floor, I'm generally ready to go. And I get take the dog out and I get my coffee and I go turn on the keyboard. And when I put my fingers on the keys, I feel like there's a kind of energy going through them. Now I know that's just my subconscious. I'm not talking about chi or anything magic.
Right.
I'm talking about, there's just this feeling when I put my fingers on those keys that I'm ready to go. This is my chance to write a beautiful scene or a powerful scene, or, you know, and when I get stuck, I say, I'll just write one sentence. And usually if I do that, it'll just flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about like tapping the barrel and the stuff just comes pouring out, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a novelist. I've written, you know, screenplays. I've sold one or two, but none that got produced. So I don't consider myself a screenwriter just yet. But, you know, I've written stuff. I've written essays. I've written, you know, stuff for Fangoria, you know, articles. I've done 20 plus years of writing about movies and stuff online, reviews, whatnot. But I've never had a problem starting something. I think that I kind of, maybe it's the same thing that you're talking about, is once you tap it, like, I don't really, I either have an instinct for where I want to start the conversation, you know, that I'm having with an essay or whatnot, or I just know if I just start writing, the rest will come. But there is something about it. And listen, I feel like I'm joining in where you're like, I'm talking to like two NASCAR drivers and I'm like, yeah. And I once drove stick on a dune buggy, you know, or whatever, you know, I feel a little bit like that going into this conversation. But
the thing I would say is that even though that's, you know, I'm making it sound like it's just always easy, and it isn't, but it mostly is pretty easy for me. And, I think it's because I've been reading all my life. I've been writing all my life. I've wanted this more than anything when I was growing up. And, you know, it's like the dog that chases the car. I caught that sucker. And I'm always feel that, you know, this is just the best job in the world. And I never worry about, you know, my daughter's always trying to help. So we're going to try to make that a bestseller. Well, you go, baby. I really appreciate it. But I don't care about that. I've got money. I've been successful at this. I've written screenplays. I've written all sorts of stuff. The most successful part of it is my family's never suffered for my work and I get to do what I want.
Right.
I mean, I'd peck shit with the chickens if it was for my family, you know, that's the thing, but I haven't had to. And, you know, like I said, I would do a lot of pen name work, and I've done some. I've done some pseudonymous work. I bought a car once for us that way. And so, you know, I'm not above it. I'm not trying to put myself in some kind of elite category.
Right.
I like to think that I write well, and I like to think that when a reader reads my stuff, not everybody's going to like it, but when they do, they have an experience.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of, we're 40 minutes into this. I could just talk to you about technique and craft for this entire thing, but we will have a small revolt on our hands if we don't talk about revival a little bit, which is your chosen topic. And this might be an interesting chat because it comes to my attention that the revival's a favorite here at the King Cast. This is a book that we try to get everybody who reads King. It seems to be the one that most people who read King like have left off for some reason. This seems to be like the forgotten album almost of King's of King's work. And this is something that Scott and I were very, it became part of the identity of the show, where we're always recommending revival to people. We're always hearing from listeners who read it on our recommendation, and we either get one of two reactions. It's either, oh my God, I can't sleep for the rest of my life. What the fuck did you do to me? Or two, this is my new favorite thing. And I'm so glad you recommended it. So, I understand that Stephen, you're not super hot on revival, so this is going to be an interesting
chat. It's not my favorite of King's stuff. It's been how many, when did it come out? It's been forever since I read that book. How old is it now?
2013, I think, so it's a little over 10 years old.
I don't remember it so well. I remember A Lightning Artist, and I remember the ant wranglers at the end, and I really like that end. I like the ant wranglers at the end. I think that is one of King's stand up best endings of all.
Well, there will be spoilers in this conversation, it's obvious.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah, I think what happened with me, I mean, you know, sometimes you read a book coming out of another book and you expect this book to be the same as the last book.
Right.
So you mess yourself up that way. But, and I don't have any memory, it's been so long, of what I was reading then. But yeah. I do remember thinking it was taking a long time to get where it's going, anyways. Right.
And it does. Yeah. But yeah. I think to the benefit of the characters in the story, at least from my perspective. But Joe, why was you gave a couple of options, but this is the one that jumped out to me. Why was this
I thought it was one of his best, most neglected novels. It's not my favorite, but it is
right. His favorite.
And what I liked about it, it was the fact that it did deal with all these characters, and then suddenly you realize that this is about something else too. Yeah. And it's about some, I've always liked that, the kind of thing that and King does that a lot and does it well, where he's telling almost a mainstream novel, but buried within it are all these little things that start to occur that then turn nasty. And it's funny. I've got that Lovecraftian influenced short story book out, but I really don't like Lovecraft's writing. What I like is ideas, and that's what King did. He took Lovecraftian ideas, but I loved all the guy was in the music business, and I think that whole thing about electricity was just fascinating to me. And you know how the guy was a preacher, as I recall, and he had this affinity for electricity, and he was always experimenting with it. And then when he had a moment, and again, I don't want to tell, I feel like I'm revealing too much, but I would just say that he had a moment when electricity let him down. It gave him there's nothing out there. There's nothing beyond. And then as you go on, you find there's something, but it's not what you would hope for, you know?
Yeah.
And novel.
You know, I feel the same way about Lovecraft, Joe. I like the ideas. I like Mountains of Madness. I love the ideas, but line by line, it always feels like he's trying to prove to the reader, look, I know all these words and I can put them together in this weird way. And it feels like needlessly ornate, I guess.
Well, you know, he's so heavily influenced, I think, by Algernon Blackwood and Arthur Miller, but he's not the writer they were.
No, he's not.
Always thought Algernon Blackwood was one of the best, and he does a lot of stuff that Lovecraft is most noted for, and it's that there's some sort of cosmic horror that there's something dark and grim and cloying lying just beyond the veil, so to speak.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, his story, The Wendigo, man, that's Blackwood, right? Yeah,
Willows, The Willows.
Yeah, yeah,
And he did many others. And he had a supernatural detective called John Silence. Those are a little bit more direct. You know, they're not as subtle. But those are fun. You know, they're fun to read. I've always liked that detective that either explores the supernatural or the supernormal, which is actual reality that we just don't understand yet.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And yeah, of course, revival is cosmic horror. And, you know, the way, I mean, can you really define cosmic horror? I've tried to do it before, and people tell me you shouldn't put fences around it. And I agree. We shouldn't make it be this or make it be that. But my take on the general shape of cosmic horror is always a character encounters something, like they peel up a corner of the wallpaper in a house, and then they see through that, under that wallpaper, there's a vast cosmic carnivorous universe, and they just want to put that wallpaper back down and not have seen that. And they have to.
You can never put it back.
Yeah, no, you never can put it back. Yeah.
And there's also, to me, that it's kind of that emptiness that I've had a few times when I would go out and lay on a hill and look up at the sky at night and just realize how little, how unimportant, how much of a speck that we all are in this massive universe.
Yeah, like every time Cthulhu trundles on the stage, you realize your own insignificance and how little you matter to anything at all.
Yeah. Absolutely. That was Lovecraft's secret, is that he found all that. And I know a lot of people say, you know, he's a racist, he was all this, but you know, we don't celebrate him for that. We celebrate him for what he did in fiction. And the other thing is a lot of that stuff, he probably wasn't that different from a lot of people at that era. You know, even in the era when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, you know, in East Texas. So I certainly recognize those traits. But in this fiction, especially as a kid, you don't really notice that. As you get older, you start to see the sort of representatives that he has for those things. But, you know, he married a Jewish lady, and all these things that he supposedly hated, he had, some sort of correspondence with all kinds of people. You know, Robert Bloch, he had correspondence with people that he influenced dramatically. So he had a Robert E. Howard, another one.
Yeah.
He had a certain amount of kindness about him. And so, you know, he was a complicated human being, like a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And he had the cool, he had the coolest name too. I think that's been a big part of his longevity. He had the cool name. And you know, King has that too. I remember seeing Stephen King's books on the spinner rack when I was a kid, and I thought that was like a title he had earned rather than his name.
It's catchy. That's
Yeah, and it makes me like really aware that I'm a Jones, you know?
Well, you know, the thing is that he influenced so many people that don't even necessarily write that.
But
he's had, when I was a kid, nobody really knew who H.P. Lovecraft was, except a few of us, you know, dyed in the wool readers of that sort of fiction. And now you see him mentioned in movies and TV shows, other books. I saw a show once where I can't remember exactly what it was, but they started talking about Lovecraftian like everybody would know. And I realized that now, a lot of people do know.
Yeah, they do, man. They do. And, you know, this being the King cast and all, Eric, isn't that one of kind of King's origin story with horror? He found some Lovecraft books in the attic.
I think it was like he was going through his dad's shit, maybe, is the story, because his dad kind of abandoned the family when he was young, and he found a bunch of that stuff in his dad's collections. Yeah, which is interesting because that's not really King's identity as a writer. He doesn't delve into Lovecraft stuff often or cosmic horror often, but when he does, it's really fucking good. It's the existential.
Jerusalem's Lot has a Lovecraftian feel,
before
it becomes Salem's Lot in the novel. But
if
you remember, that story is very Lovecraftian.
Yeah, the short story Jerusalem's Lot, the prequel essentially short story. Yeah. It has the Necronomicon in it, for fuck's sake.
But, you know, I think King doesn't lean into cosmic horror very much because he's written a lot of stories, but I think he's mostly known as a novelist, and that's what usually gets adapted, it seems like. And cosmic horror, the shape of it does not conform to the three-act structure of a feature film because generally you have a ramp up at the end into either redemption or just missed redemption or something like that. And in cosmic horror, there is hardly ever redemption. It's just like, this is bad and now this is worse, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. I think I think that kind of horror best serves itself in short stories.
I think so too. I totally think so too. Yeah, I think cosmic horror has its home in the short story.
And I'll say something that might be controversial. I think most horror works better in short stories.
Oh, interesting.
That's an absolute by any means.
Yeah.
But I do believe that short stories are better designed to write horror tales.
I think so too. And I think a part of that for me is that, like in a novel, if I write a horror novel, then I think the reader has the expectation that I'm going to let one person survive or win or kill the monster or something like that, just so that their investment of intellect and emotion is paid off. But in a short story, you never know. Everyone could be dead on the floor at the end, or they could kill the monster. And I think that not knowing makes horror work really well in the short form.
It's more dangerous for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing when you're going, and I've noticed this in both your writing, but I've also noticed it in King's writing too, where it's like you can feel like there's a little bit of the hair being let down when the short stories come out, where it's a little bit like, I'm going to experiment with shit. King has whole short stories that are just poetry, you know, and you know, he's like, I'm going to do a poetry short story. I'm going to do an existential horror one. I'm going to do a drama story. Now I'm going to have one where a doctor is eating pieces of himself to keep alive while he's stranded on an island. You know, it's like,
Well, that's the power of short stories, is that it gives a writer an urge to experiment and try something different, because they're not married to a singular tone. You know, they may have a style that's the same, but they know they can switch about with different kinds of stories within a genre or outside a genre,
right?
Or find things where the genre. I never like it when they say mixed. I like it when you say blended, because mixed. Yeah. That's just those sections stand out. Like you're doing a mystery, a Western or a horror Western. And when you think of it that way, that's two separate things that are welded uncomfortably together. But blended, there's a nature to that that's hard. It's hard to explain, but you know the difference when you read it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And you never write a Western that's only a Western. It's going to have a romance in it. It's going to have some action in it. And you never write a horror that's only horror. It's going to have other stuff blended in, like you're talking about.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now, Joe, you mentioned you're not a religious man. I'm not a religious guy either. Steven, I don't think we've ever talked about your faith.
Not either. No.
But what's interesting to me is how religion is handled in Revival, and how the main character loses his faith, but also becomes obsessed with, like you said, piercing the veil of what's on the other side. And even as a non-religious person, I don't have an obsession about it, but I am curious about it. It's like, is there something beyond this? I tend to think that, like, we go to when I've been asked before, like, what do you think happens when we die? I'm like, my answer is the same thing that happened before we were born. Right. It's like, you know, I think that is what makes sense to me. Like, we're just going to go back to, you know, to non-existence, peaceful non-existence and that actually sounds pretty wonderful.
It's not even a matter of knowing the answers. It's just knowing what's bullshit. You know,
right.
The exact answers. But for me, religion, all of the religions are bullshit.
And
I mean, the Bible's fascinating reading. I mean, you got your murder, you got your incest, you got, you know, everything.
Yeah, and you got giants.
Yeah.
You got epic floods. Yeah.
Because of the editing nature of the way Old Testament and New Testament were done. You read the Apocrypha, you got Jesus, who is essentially a thug. You know, and it's really interesting to read all of that and see the perspective that the people who essentially created Christianity out of all of these basic beliefs, pagan beliefs and such, put it together and said, okay, we want it to be like this. And now let's edit it. There's even some of the Old Testament where you can see where they would write in the margin, stop changing this, you know, when the monks were doing it. And there's a place where they first kind of came up with the Noah story, which was probably borrowed from Gilgamesh, you know.
Yeah,
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, as for what happens after we die, I always prefer that answer Keanu Reeves gave, that what happens after you die is that the people you love and who loved you, they'll miss you, you know?
Right.
That's about the only thing we can know, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there is something about the curiosity about it though, too. And that's the thing that I'm most drawn to in this story is you have this guy, Reverend Jacobs, who, you know, is kind of this altruistic, ah, shucks, you know, leave it to Beaver, you know, happy preacher at the beginning. He has some tragedy that befalls him and his wife and young son die, and that shakes his faith. And then he spends the rest of the story kind of as a charlatan, you know, playing with this secret electricity, but he's doing it for a reason, because he is, even though he is, you know, sworn off God and sworn off religion, he desperately wants some of his previous faith to be real, because if so, then he's going to get to see his wife and kid again.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And there's something about that that it's so engaging to me and makes him such a fascinating character, even though he's leaving such destruction in his wake. As we find out, the secret electricity is kind of has some healing powers, but everything that it touches to heal, it fucks up 10 times worse than whatever it's healing. There's something about this story that I can't escape. Like, it keeps calling to me and I keep revisiting it. And yes, the ending is great and King gets shit for a lot of his endings sometimes. And this is the one that I point to going, all right, motherfuckers, enjoy this. Right. You can talk all the shit you want.
That's not popular. That ending is right, but it's not right for a lot of readers, probably.
Yeah.
And I think I'm glad that he didn't try to bend it into some sort of, you know, happy or even bittersweet. It's just bitter.
It is. Yeah. 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 It's dark.
And, I just love the idea. And maybe this is where the Lovecraftian element comes into, but because it's a guy searching for something. And then when it's discovered, it's better off not knowing. Right.
Yeah, for sure. Better off
not knowing it. And I think that's kind of the heart of cosmic horror. And that's the real interesting thing about that genre, is that there is no, you know, and to Lovecraft's credit, you know, it's, I kind of agree with you that, like, as a writer, he wasn't particularly strong, but what he could put forward was a tone. And I think when you get that tone right, there's nothing else like it. There's no other flavor that comes close to it. And I just love the existential dread that it comes with. And I guess that's why I love, you know, when King dives into this, because he doesn't do it too often. But when he does, you get Crouch End, you get this, you get Jerusalem's Lot, you get maybe even The Jaunt. You can say has Lovecraftian elements to it. You know, it's like,
You know what I like about that, what you're talking about, Eric, is that one of our most favorable or advantageous, characteristics is our curiosity. But in cosmic horror, it's that curiosity that always leads to that terrible, dark, horrible ending. And like for Revival, you can read Revival kind of as King's fleshed out version of Herbert West, you know?
You know, it also reminds me, the ants, especially reminds me of Quatermass. Quatermass in the Pit, which there's that element where they see that these aliens form into, with electricity, by the way.
Yeah.
And which is how they eventually affect it, is swinging a girder into it with electricity. But nonetheless, they're like ants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it shows, there's this one scene where you see Mars and it's just these ants hopping along or whatever. So when I read that, I thought, aha, you know, that's exactly where that scene came from.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good call. And, you know, ants are so strong at the size they are. So if they're big enough to be cowboys over the herd of dead humans, then they must be terribly dangerous, man.
Well, I was writing, I'd started a novel, because I really haven't written many horror novels. I've written a lot of horror stories and maybe three horror novels. But I was thinking about writing this story. I was doing it where it was like a dimensional opening that they had to use some sort of, you know, common magical stuff to hold back. But if you went through that, it was occupied by these alien ants that rode people and put their, you know, there's a kind of ant, a kind of spider rather, that will get an ant and ride it and make turn it into a zombie, really. A zombie, sticks its stuff in there and sucks out the good, but this thing will continue to be alive and it just becomes like its mount. And, so I was writing that story, but it was probably too cosmic for me. I may return to it at some point, but I always think that insects are really good, creepy aliens.
No, you're totally right about that. And, you know, I wonder if using ants in particular as like the bad guys or something, if that does it belie some like fear of communism? Because ants are communes, basically. You know, they have a single hive mind and all that. I don't know. I don't see that in King's work, but I'm there. Mm-hmm. You know, together. Yeah.
Fire ants.
Yeah.
Red commie fire ants. Yeah. Oh, red. Yeah.
That's right. You know, my trick when I was growing up that I could always get the girls looking at me for was anytime there was a fire ant bed, I'd walk up to it and put my hand in it and let the ants like cover my hand and go up my arm. And I would always say, look, they're not biting me. And that was cool for a little bit. And then they would all decide to bite me, you know?
So why didn't they bite you right? Like if a fire ant gets a whiff of me, then it's fucking stings me. So like how the fuck do you?
I think
it'll chase me down and sting me. So how the fuck do you put your hand into a fire ant mound?
I just never had that right kind of fear, I think. And they couldn't, like a dog, they couldn't smell it on me. But after a while, they'd figure out, hey, this ain't one of us. And then they'd go to town on me. But we were playing hide and seek once at a lake down around Austin. And I hid in some tall grass. Turns out I was hiding right on a big old fire ant bed. And it was either get found or let all these ants sting me for the whole time. And I just had to let them sting me. And I was all swole up and everything. But I didn't get found, so I won, man.
That's one way of looking at it.
Did you, though? Joe, if you're – I don't know how much time you've spent talking with Mr. Stephen Graham Jones about his different wildlife encounters. But it's not a kink –
No, I hadn't talked about wildlife encounters. Yeah.
It's not a KingCast episode with Stephen on the show without some sort of crazy nonsense. He's told stories about finding dead spider shrines between walls and grabbing random snakes off of the road, driving.
I had those same experiences too. You know, one of the things I remember is an insect experience was going into an old house. I can't remember why I was there, but you're in there and you start to see the wallpaper move.
Yeah,
and then you realize it's roaches. The wallpaper, it's covered in roaches. And if you were to cut that open or break it open, they would come out of there just in piles.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's wicked, man. I snuck into one of those old houses once. Well, I didn't sneak in. I was chasing a porcupine, and which is not the smartest thing. It's not the smartest thing you can do, and the porcupine was pretty quick. He didn't want to be caught. And so this house had fallen down. The walls had collapsed. So it was just a roof with lots of junk under it. And the porcupine had a little den in there, I guess. And I chased it in to narrow and narrower spaces and finally got to where I was having to crawl on my belly, and I could still see the porcupine just out of reach. And it nosed itself into a corner, and I think it thought it was invisible, but I sneaked up and I stole one of its quills and was able to get out without getting slapped. And I always consider that a coup of some sort, man.
True enough. The encounters I hated the most were water moccasins, you know.
Oh, right. They'll chase you, man. They're scary.
And, you know, the wildlife people say, well, they're not really do that. They don't chase, well, except for the ones that are chasing. You know? They must have not got the memo, you know.
No, man. Those things are wicked.
They are. They're standing over one. We don't chase people, man. What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you thinking? Old walking. I'm gonna chase him.
Yeah, maybe they're just going the same direction I am. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be.
Are you guys freaked out by insects at all? Because you're telling this story about the roaches, and roaches never bothered me. I know that the roaches bother a lot of people, but they don't.
No, they don't scare me or anything like that. But that is eerie to see all that wallpaper.
Oh, 100%. That would freak me out. Don't get me wrong.
That must be. But I don't have any real big fear of insects. You know, I do snakes less so as I've grown older.
Right.
Snakes have always creeped me out. You know. Mm-hmm. And, I think that may be the only thing like that I can.
Yeah.
It's, you know, if you get in the water, there's sharks. Hey, those creep me out.
Right. Yes. Snapping turtles terrify me. But as far as But as far as insects go, the one insect I grew up with a great, great fear of was those whip scorpions, which I think people call camel spiders now, if I'm not mistaken. But I'd catch those when I was a kid, and we'd always catch, you know, centipedes, black widows, scorpions. We had all the whole menagerie in jars, and you could put a whip scorpion in with any of those and it would kill whatever is fighting instantly. And it would be done in 5 seconds or less. And for that reason, I always knew I did not want to tangle with one of them dudes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I got hit by a scorpion once, and believe me, it was nasty.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had, in my middle school here in Austin, we had like scorpions in the science lab. Like we had scorpion like in glass terrariums and stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember there was this one kid in that class that would always like to fucking torture them. And I don't know why, like maybe the teacher wasn't paying attention. He didn't notice it, but what he wouldn't like kill them. But this is kind of a screwed up kid. Like I think he had a lot of issues. He was a cutter. He cut himself a lot. And like, I don't know. It definitely felt like he was working through some shit, but he would hold his pencil. He would hold him down with the pencil and like force them to like start stinging the pencil. And that was like the thing that made him happy. And I just remember going like, am I looking at a serial killer here? Or is that curious?
Well, I think he just hated that pencil.
Yeah, for sure.
He's trying to kill the pencil. That's what it was.
No, in junior high, we had scorpions all over our school too. And I'd let them, again, to impress girls, or let scorpions crawl on my arm until they clamped their feet down like a little backhoe. And that's when you know they're about to whip you with that tail. And I would always knock them off at that point. I try not to kill them because it wasn't their fault that I was using them to talk to girls. But so much stuff in my life has been to impress girls. And
did any of this work, Steven? Like, did you get...
No,
were you just getting like batting women off left and right because they were like, oh my god, you let fire ants and scorpions crawl in?
exactly, man. No, well, the problem was I didn't know how to talk to girls, and so I thought I could impress girls, and I think that's a mistake a lot of people have made throughout history.
Yeah, this is a little bit off the subject, but didn't you one time, Steven, pick me up at the Brown Hotel?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, here in Denver. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, man. Yeah.
I had to ask that. It has nothing to do with our...
Yeah. but no, I think that might have been the same time. And this is one of my favorite stories, and it really taught me how to try to be a better person. Joe, I don't know if you remember, you and I were cruising through Denver, going to Tattered Cover, probably. And we were at a big old intersection, and we were at the very front. There are four cars side by side. We're at the very front, and this homeless guy is pushing his bicycle across through the crosswalk while the light is in his favor, and his knee collapses and he falls down on his bike and he can't get up. And of the probably 200 people sitting there at that intersection, Joe was the only one who had his feet on the ground before the homeless guy even fell. And Joe was out there helping him get across that intersection. And I always remember that I need to try to be the first person helping too, you know?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you didn't see that he was stealing all of his shit while he was moving him across the road. So
yeah, and that tire's gonna come off later because I got this. You do your best.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't talk a whole lot about Revival, but I am so psyched to have you guys on here. Is there anything that you want to like kind of circle back and hit on Revival before we wrap things up here, gentlemen?
I'm just going to say that I think it's one of his most underrated novels.
Right.
For some reason, it really pulled my chain. And I think mostly what does it for me is the mystery and dealing with the electricity and what this is changing this guy to be. And I also like the story about the guy's life as a musician and all of that. And I remember when I read Cujo, it was really the story I wanted to read was the one about those guys working in, I guess it was cereal.
With this dying the cereal. Yeah.
It's a straight novel, you know, it was kind of like the man in the gray flannel suit, you know.
Right.
And then the dog stuff, I really wasn't that interested in, but I really like that mainstream part. And I always felt like, oh, let's bring the dog back. Let's just have this whole thing.
Let's get to the Mad Men part of Cujo.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mad Men's very much the man in the gray flannel suit.
Yes.
If you've never read it, it's a really good book. But and what makes Sammy run and stuff like that. I thought of those kind of novels that were very popular in the 50s, for example. Which, you know, that could be what Stephen had read some things of that name. I'm sure he has. Right. But that was my best part of that. And my best part of revival to me was just these characters and how their lives were affected.
Right.
You know, the preacher by what happened to his son, and then the musician by, you know, just trying to find his place in life. And then, right. Of course, the other part I did like in this one, I was interested in these, the angry ants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I wonder if the reason that I initially resisted revival is that I've always had a serious weakness for electricity. I can't see like electricity arcing from here to there without sneaking over and sticking my finger in, you know, and my whole life has been putting things in light sockets and getting shocked and knocking all the circuits out. And when I drive tractor for 16, 18 hours, I would have to get off every few rows and pull a spark plug cable off and stick my finger in it to get shocked to wake me up. And so I'm always afraid that I'm going to go too far with electricity and it's going to get hold of me in the wrong way someday. So
Now I'm afraid you're going to go too far with electricity with this.
Afraid it's going to be insects, electricity. Get hold of yourself, fair man.
I know, man. I know.
No, I mean, you're going to die like 107 years old, like of natural causes, but you're going to do your goddamnedest trying to fucking kill yourself in a random way.
He's powered by electricity, but you're going to see the ants, Stephen. The ants.
Yeah. Mother is waiting for all of us at the end of this, so yeah. Joe, you mentioned that you have that Lovecraft inspired book of short stories. You want to tell everybody about it right now, or at the end of things give it a little plug before we wrap up?
I'll give it a little plug. I'm also going to give Sugar on the Bones a little plug. I think it's better Hap and Leonard novels. I like them all in different, you know, ways, but I think it's one of the better of the later ones. And I like it. Because I think it's very suspenseful. I like the characterization and the writing. So I'm going to give myself a plug there because, you know, if you don't toot your own horn, nobody will toot it.
Yeah.
The Lovecraft thing is a collection of stories that I've written over a period of time that have elements of Lovecraft in them or were somewhat driven or inspired by. And I picked the very best ones that I'd written because there are probably a few others. And I always find it interesting that I've written those because as we were talking earlier, I'm not really truly a fan of Lovecraft's writing, but his ideas have really stuck with me and influenced a lot of what I do. And so I think people who like Lovecraft but don't want to read that style and want different approaches to it will really enjoy it.
Hmm. Yeah. And you know, Sugar on the Bones, it's a book that really pays off having read the previous 12 books because there's a little bit of a reunion aspect that feels so, so wonderful in that novel. And I would also plug the adaptation of The Thicket, you know? I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful novel, but when it's adapted to film, I think it's one of the top tier Westerns. It is really amazing. It blew me away, man.
Yeah, Juliette Lewis, who is a sweetheart, by the way, she was so good in that. And they in my book it was a man, they made it a woman, and that's the thing I thought, damn, I wish I'd have thought of that.
That was a good choice. You even got James Hetfield in there. That is amazing.
That is right. Yeah, that's a James Hetfield's in there. And Leslie Grace, who was the Batgirl that got canceled, but she did other stuff, and she was very, very good. And another sweetheart. And I Peter, when I was at the I guess it was Calgary. It was at Los Angeles premiere. Uh-huh. Came to the front of the stage and really said some nice things about me and the book.
Oh, nice.
Everybody was, you know, I didn't get to go on the set, but everybody, including the director, Elliot, was just a very, very nice that they felt the way they did about it, you know?
Yeah. Nice. And the director has like a really clear vision of what he wants. And when they're working with top tier material as well, then something can really be head out of the park. And this is one of those cases where it's really head out of the park, I think.
Yeah. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, I thought you were going to plug one of your own things, but here you are being a team player, helping Joe out. I appreciate it. Well, gentlemen, this has been a wonderful chat. I'm so, so pleased to have gotten you on the show, Joe. And Stephen, you're a delight as always, and you both of you have an open invitation. Anytime you need to plug anything, you're more than welcome to come back. Or if you just want to bullshit more about the writing process, or you know, Stephen sticking his tongue in the electric sockets or whatever the fuck, you're more than welcome. So thank you both so much.
This was great. Thanks for talking, y'all.
Appreciate it.
Many thanks to Joe R. Lansdale for coming in for such a lovely chat about the work of Stephen King. I know that we were supposed to be talking about Revival or focused on it. And sometimes you just kind of got to go where the conversation's going to go. When you have somebody like Joe R. Lansdale on, you just kind of follow his lead. And in this case, that ended up being a wide-ranging chat. But I still think you got a lot of Stephen King goodness in there. So I'm not even going to apologize for not covering Revival. So take that. I want to also thank my special guest co-host and semi-permanent fixture here on the show, Stephen Graham Jones. I'm already looking forward to our next chat about weird animal shit. You know it's coming. And before I sign off, here's your friendly reminder to throw the show a few bucks via Patreon, and you'll get so many bonus episodes. Hundreds are there now, and new ones pop up every single week. This week, I'm joined by Stephen King Smarty Pants, Mr. Zach Dion, to talk over the recent revelation from Cy King that he's dipping his toes back into the world of the Dark Tower. I don't know if you've seen these tweets. Very exciting. It went from I'm going to be playful about kind of thinking about going back to Dark Tower to some like, okay, the shit's getting real. So me and Zach kind of look at those tweets. We decipher what they mean and what we can maybe expect from a new King Dark Tower story. We talk about all the possible options, and we might even come close to getting one of them right. You never know. To listen to that and to all of our backlog of episodes, 4 years worth, go sign up over at patreon.com/thekingcast and get your ass subscribed. And that's all I got to say for now. So I'll sign off by wishing you all a very happy, safe, and spooky Halloween. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.